The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Sonia Soda.
I agreed an extension to the Brexit process to the end of October at the latest.
Please do not waste this time.
The Brexit ball was in the EU's court this week, and after a marathon six-hour session and some foul play from Emmanuel Macron, they finally agreed to an extension until October the 31st. Crisis averted, for now at least. But with the Independent Group and Nigel Farage's new Brexit Party gearing up for battle in the European elections next month, Tory leadership hopefuls waiting for their chance to strike, and still no breakthrough in the cross-party Brexit talks of May and Corbyn, there's still plenty of calamities which could befall our hapless Prime Minister between now and October. Also this week, could the Conservatives have an even bigger problem on the horizon than Brexit? Where have all the young Tories gone? That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, to no one's great surprise, Theresa May's request for a short Brexit delay was torn up by the EU27 last night, with the offer instead of extending Britain's membership of the EU until Halloween. In the early hours of the morning, Donald Tusk held a press conference to warn the UK, please do not waste this time. But a solution looks as elusive as ever. A customs deal with Labour could see all-out war break out in both Tory and Labour ranks. The DUP won't help get May's deal over the line. And a second referendum remains a remote possibility. So what gives? Well, I'm joined to discuss all this by Owen Jones and Polly Toynbee from The Guardian and Will Tanner from Onward. Polly, if I could start with you, what happened in Brussels last night and why did the meeting take 6 hours?
What happened in Brussels was very interesting because it was partly about the state and the battle for power within the last 27 inside. It was more about them than it was actually about us. It was always plain we were going to get a long extension and Theresa May would just have to lump it, whatever it was. But it was really about Macron trying to do a de Gaulle and trying to seize power from the Germans, which is interesting. It begins to show how different Europe's going to be without us there, because we were something of a balance between the Franco-German sort of nexus. And there's going to be a reorganising. This may not be of much interest to us right now, but what happened to us is what will happen to us time and time again. We are vassals. Our overlords told us where to get off and how we had to obey them.
And Owen, what do you think Macron was playing at in pushing for a shorter extension than everyone else seemed to want?
He's got his own domestic troubles. I mean, for a start, we need to remember when, one of the planks that Macron had in his presidential campaign, which was actually quite interesting for someone who's not politically very sympathetic to Macron, to say the least, was, for example, to confront Germany over the Eurozone rules. So the very strict fiscal rules to have a fiscal transfers and so on within the Eurozone to help ease the pressure on those countries most hit by austerity like Portugal, Greece and Spain. So he always had his own kind of, he did have a more independent break and actually was very frustrated because the Germans basically faced him down on that. So it's quite interesting that he is here again trying to find or establish some level of independence from a bloc which is obviously still dominated by the German government and has been for a very long time. But I think there's also, we've got to bear in mind, he's in huge domestic, under huge domestic pressures. It is also the case, we should make it clear that, I mean, no deal is catastrophic for this country, but France would be the worst hit by a no deal situation. So it is interesting.
So you don't think he'd have ever let it come to that?
I really doubt it. I think it would be, you know, the shock that the French economy would hit, would suffer, given his own domestic troubles. But that's not to say we hold all the cards as the Brexiteers would have it. We hold almost no cards. But that is at least some comfort, I suppose, the British government can have.
And Will, we saw Theresa May go into the summit last night asking again for a June extension, which got rejected last time. Why was she asking for it again when she basically knew she wouldn't get it?
Well, I think what Theresa was doing was effectively setting out her reluctant position to ask for another extension, making clear that she didn't want one and wanted the shortest possible extension in order to force her own parliament and her own party to come to some kind of conclusion through this dastardly kind of saga. And ultimately, she got something in the sense that we have a break clause at the end of June, which is essentially kind of partially what she wanted, but then a longer extension if we don't meet that. So this was it was a kind of halfway house between those that wanted a very long extension and those that wanted a short extension, and one that probably doesn't really satisfy any side, but potentially gives us a bit more respite to get a negotiating.
The other thing, of course, as well, Macron was disturbed by, Macron's government, were the noises by the likes of Jacob Rees-Mogg that the British government could, whilst still a member, would use that position to basically cause lots of havoc. And there was a view, which the French government have privately obviously been briefing, that as bad as no deal would be, as I said, for the French economy, it would be less bad than having a intentionally destabilising Britain exporting its internal political crisis to the entire EU bloc.
Rees-Mogg has got away with something that would have been called treachery, betrayal, enemy of the people. To interfere with international negotiations in that way is absolutely outrageous. Somebody on the left had done that, they would have been slaughtered.
Do you think it's a real threat, Polly? I mean, do you think that's something the EU actually need to worry about?
Well, you never know. We don't know what kind of leader. If Theresa May gets toppled, we don't know. It looks as if she probably won't. But if she did, and if she was replaced by a Dominic Raab or a Boris Johnson or any of the rest of them, who will have to swear blind they're all no dealers in order to get selected by the mad small group of Tory activists, then possibly somebody could cause real trouble. I think, you know, Boris proofing everything will be very important.
And Will, you talked about this break clause. Is there really any chance it's a break clause that we'll be using? Do you think we'll see Theresa May bring her withdrawal agreement back for a vote? Do you think there's any chance it might get passed by MPs?
Well, I do think that, there's negotiations going on with Labour. I think the great irony of the process is that actually that small gang of Brexiteers that Polly talks about, if they really want to get what they say they want, i.e. a new leader, the best way to do that would be to go for the withdrawal agreement and vote through this stage of Brexit.
But aren't they just better off holding out for a no-deal Brexit the end of the cliff edge in October now?
The reality is no deal is pretty far from the table. It's probably not completely off the table, but it's a very unlikely scenario. Parliament's made its wishes pretty clear. I think it's highly unlikely the EU would also accept that outcome. And we probably are into a stage of kind of rolling extensions. Just to go back on the previous point, I mean, the reality is we are still an EU member state with all the rights and obligations that exist with that. We can use all of the powers that any EU member state can do through this period of extension. So actually, there's very little last night to restrict what the UK can do in the agreement between the UK and other member states.
Except if we were really obstructive, if we became the enemy of the other 27, I mean, their vengeance would be wreaked on us, and we need a deal. Whatever's going to happen next, we don't want to be the pariahs and the outcasts. It will do us in more than it'll do them in.
Well, exactly. I mean, even if the no-deal scenario happens, I've always believed it was exceptionally unlikely, but we would still then have to have a deal with the European Union over everything from, you know, they wouldn't open trade negotiations until we settle our divorce bill. We'd have to have negotiations over the border in Ireland. There's this view of no deal being this mic drop, walk away, that's it. You know, we're suddenly free and liberated and the EU can stuff themselves. They are our biggest trading bloc, and they obviously economically we need them far more than the other way round, and we will in every scenario have to go to them. If we damage that goodwill, I mean, it's put to me before the referendum, when I met several EU diplomats who were horrified about the fact they thought Brexit, obviously, I thought it was going to happen. And they, you know, they pointed out they had their own internal political dynamics to contend with. If they suffered any economic backlash themselves from Brexit, their voters would be even more angry and would put pressure on them to take a harder line. So if Britain wants to make itself this hate figure in Europe, that will, you know, contribute to those internal political dynamics, and political leaders will have to cater for the demands, the anger, the fury of their own electorate.
What Tusk said quite clearly was, of course, you could extend it beyond Halloween if you want, that, you know, this can stretch into the far distant future. We don't know where we'll be in October, but it may well be that we really do want and need a longer extension if we are perhaps at some point going to revoke, but perhaps not quite by then. So, you know, we need to have friendly relations with them, whatever comes next.
And Polly, do you think there's any chance of Theresa May getting her deal through in the next 6 months?
Well,
or even a deal?
If it weren't that the ERG absolutists weren't so crazy, you would look at the electoral situation, you'd say, right, so they're going to go into a confrontation with Farage in the Euro elections, which we'd have to fight. They will be destroyed by that. It might wreck the Tory party, absolutely. And incidentally, Labour too, if they don't fight that election as Remainers and referendumites. So do they really want to do that? Or would they really rather settle this to avoid having to have a European election? That's the tough choice for them next.
And where do you think they're going to come down on that?
I think they're mad as stoats, and I think that they will pursue their, you know, that little group, that little really hard knot of people who haven't surrendered up until now. I don't think they'll give in. I don't know. What do you think, Will?
I don't think the ERG is likely to back down. I think they've made it abundantly clear, and the DUP has too, that they are set against the Prime Minister's deal or anything like it, and they won't countenance anything with a backstop in it. It's clear from the European Union that they're not likely to change the backstop. So I do think that Theresa has been forced to find a compromise elsewhere. Ultimately, she's been forced into that position. She's done so reluctantly, but she has now decided that the only way to get any type of deal through is with the help of Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party. And I think that probably does increase the likelihood of her deal plus a customs union making it through Parliament. I suspect we will see that voted on in the next few weeks. And I suspect there is probably a Commons majority for that. That will not satisfy a large portion of the Conservative Party. And there will be, I suspect, some lasting damage to the broad church, the coalition that the Tory party represents. But ultimately, Theresa's kind of ambition is to get Brexit delivered, to deliver on the will of the British people. She thinks that's more important for the country than the potential lasting damage to her own party. And she's kind of going about it by hook or by crook to try and get it done.
That's quite an optimistic assessment of the chances of cross-party talks succeeding. Owen, do you agree? You're someone who's written before that you think that Labour should compromise with the Tories on a soft Brexit. What are the chances of that happening?
Well, my view was if Labour could get the Tories to capitulate to their own red lines, then fine. I mean, if it was a permanent customs union...
Do you think that goes far enough, a permanent customs union?
No, as well as, no, sorry, no. Very close alignment with the single market. As well, I mean, personally, I would prefer Common Market 2.0, full membership of the single market. But in terms of as close alignment as is possible, plus, for example, no prospect of divergence on workers' rights, environmental rights. In fact, you automatically update your own workers' rights, consumer rights, environmental rights in line with the EU bloc. I don't see, in any sense, the Conservative Party being willing to surrender to those red lines.
That you would accept that, would you, without a referendum?
So my own view on a referendum is I would prefer to avoid one, even though it may well become a necessary evil. I think the first referendum has caused incalculable damage to British politics. It's unleashed a disastrous culture war which divides communities. It's turned people into Remainers and Leavers. We're not. There should be. It's the majority versus a rapacious elite which keeps plunging this country into crisis. I think the next referendum will be far more vicious, far more bitter, unleash even worse demons.
Don't you think Brexit might unleash those demons, though?
Well, I mean, it has. We're already where we are. What we've learned from...
But the reality of Brexit. Well, there's a lot of evidence that shows that, you know, if we go through with Brexit, whether it's, you know, quite a soft Brexit to a hard Brexit, the communities that will be most affected are actually Labour supporting communities in the Midlands and in the North East and the North West.
My view is there's no good options. As soon as you accept there's no good options, it's quite a liberating position to be in. I mean, I think we'd lose the second referendum all over again. I think the complacency of those who thought Remain would win the first time round, which I didn't, it hasn't gone away. The Leave campaign would run under Tell Them Again. The lead that Remain has in the average polling, if you look actually before the referendum campaign started, Remain had a huge whopping lead over Leave, which is why it was seen as impossible to lose. I remember being told by someone on referendum night that someone in Number 10 had told them Remain had won by a 10-point lead, which just shows how unbelievably complacent and out of touch they were. So my own view is if you have a soft Brexit, I don't think most people would notice. I don't think it would have much of an impact on most people's lives. I think there would still be bitterness and anger, whatever we now do. But another referendum campaign, which will, you know, when people say things are already bitter and divided, I've noticed, but it's a lack of imagination to see how much worse things can get. And Leave voters, if you speak to them, as well as Remain voters, are boiling. And just quickly, the only thing that I think's happened since the referendum campaign is not a shift between Remain and Leavers votes in any significant fashion. Continuity Remain has made a big chunk of Remain voters, existing Remain voters, more angry about Brexit.
There were also more Remain voters, the polling shows.
Well, as I've said, the polling lead that Remain has, I mean, Remain had a very big lead before the referendum campaign began. As soon as when you see the election in the general elections, when Jeremy Corbyn's approval rating starts very low, then goes up during the general election, you see the same with what happened when the referendum campaign began with Leave. Suddenly, as soon as the debate started, at the moment there is a Remain campaign going on, there isn't really a Leave campaign.
Polly, what do you make of all this?
I think Labour would be destroyed if it became the midwife, the enabler of any kind of Brexit. I mean, all Brexit's bad. I mean, as Owen says, you know, the options look pretty dreadful. There's no doubt a referendum is risky. But if Jeremy Corbyn becomes the harbinger, the deliverer of Brexit, then he owns it, along with the Tories. This is not a Labour disease. Labour is not responsible for this in any way. It's a Tory sickness that is, they've managed to infect the rest of the country. Labour has to be the healer and the doctor, put it back together again.
Does that mean?
Well, what it means is that they don't, they try and have a referendum and try and win it. They might lose, it's true. But you'd be no worse off than you were before. Whereas, supposing Jeremy Corbyn were to come to power and he was in charge of Brexit and it was his Brexit, think of how the overwhelming number of Labour voters, Labour supporters, Labour members are all passionate Remainers. It would destroy the Labour Party. It would simply split.
And do you think the Labour... Yeah, so what would happen to the Parliamentary Labour Party if Corbyn were to strike a deal with May?
It's hard to know. You'd have a Euro election in which there was a huge migration of Labour votes to the Greens, to the Lib Dems, to the Change UK. It would be really quite shattering for Labour to have lost. All of Corbyn's innocence is being lost through his prevarication over this. All the people, young people, who passionately believed that he didn't speak with forked tongues, he was the only honest man, he's already blown that. It would be seriously blown if he really does enable this to happen.
And Will, can I come to you on the Tories? Because you sounded quite optimistic back then about chances of a cross-party compromise on a customs union. Wouldn't that break the Tory party?
So can I come on to that? Because I just want to pick up on something that Polly just said. So I don't think Brexit is either the Tories' Brexit or a Labour Brexit. And I don't think Labour can avoid being some kind of midwife of this process. Everyone has their hands dipped in this blood. Everyone will come out of it badly. And all of the polling shows that people across the political divide think Westminster as a whole is broken, not just any one party. And I do think that the idea that lots of Northern Labour voting Leave voters would kind of welcome the description of themselves as part of a Tory sickness, I think they would find that quite appalling. With regard to the Tory party, I mean, the Tory party is a fragile coalition right now. In some respects, it's already split into different camps.
But there's further that those splits could go, aren't there?
Absolutely. I mean,
the party could break up.
I actually think that is a possibility. The party has split before, it split in 1846. I don't think we're yet at that point, but there are lots of members of parliament within the Conservative Party who aren't really talking to one another right now, and who sit on very different positions when it comes to Brexit. Actually, the great thing would be for them all to come together and actually vote for something positively, rather than engaging in this kind of backstabbing, kind of horrible internecine warfare, which is just damaging our politics irreparably.
I think it's exceptionally likely there will be a Labour and Tory deal of any sort on Brexit. And I also think if a general election happens, Labour is likely to do two things. A, pledge to renegotiate the deal, but B, put it to a referendum afterwards. Lots of problems with that. Labour going to spend, the first year of their term in office, depending on an extension, faffing around with a referendum, which is going to divide the party themselves. David Cameron went through all of that.
But how do we get to a general election in the first place? Because it's really hard to see Tory hardliners either voting for a general election or voting in a vote of no confidence in their own government. I just don't see how we get to a general election.
I mean, it depends, you know, in the coming months, just how this kind of... I mean, because at the moment there is no parliamentary arithmetic for everything. We could just end up with a situation where it's just extension followed by extension. We are just trapped in purgatory for the rest of our lives. That's entirely possible. But you could see a new party leader taking over and then you know, attempting to go to the country to get a mandate for their different sort of Brexit, because obviously Dominic Raab would not be able to get a Dominic Raab Brexit through the existing parliament, neither would Boris Johnson, or neither would any Tory leader who, and bear in mind, there will be two candidates put to the party membership, though four has been floated, but two normally, and that party membership has been UKIPised. If you want to win, you've got to be the most frothing at the mouth candidate in order to do so. So I think there'll be a lot of pressure for a general election in that scenario. But yeah, I think the other, just again on the referendum though, I mean, when people say, you know, if we have a referendum and lose again, we'll just be in the exact same situation we're in now, I just strongly disagree with that, because they will say Remainers refused to accept the referendum result. They did everything they could to stop it. They dragged us through another bitter and divisive, far more than the first one, referendum. They lost. Now they're being driven from public life. We will never listen to these people again. We will have the hardest possible Brexit. And, you know, we will never listen to these people. And we will be blamed for the bitterness and the division, even though they're the ones who whipped it up. So I just think that's why for some of us, we just think we want Remain. We lost the referendum. Try and settle with the softest Brexit possible. That bears in mind we only lost narrowly. But if a referendum's the only way of breaking this deadlock, so be it. But it will be a horrendous event for this country, in my opinion.
Polly, do you think the chances of a second referendum have gone up now?
I think they have. I can't see how she can get her deal. If she is determined still to get her deal through, or her deal plus Ken Clark's customs union, I don't think Labour can agree to that, except by saying, all right, we'll nod it through with a referendum. I don't think there's any other agreement available. I think the Kyle Wilson amendment was very cleverly crafted, by which you really could have an agreement.
And can I just to finish off, get you all very briefly to say what the chances are that you think that we're going to be in exactly the same position as we are today come, you know, 27th of October?
I don't think we'll be in the same position as we are today. I think we will have left the European Union with a deal by that point.
Wow. Bold prediction. Polly?
I think we will be coming to terms with the idea we're going to remain in one way or another. And it seems to me it needs a referendum, but it might in the end end up revoking, but another long extension and maybe better leadership all round.
And Owen, what's your prediction?
I think there's a significant chance Theresa May will be toppled after May the 22nd. That's what they're currently focusing on now, the Tories. But then again, you know, we always said she was a zombie prime minister, but anyone who watches zombie films know that zombies, A, can do a lot of damage, and B, are often very hard to destroy. So maybe we will just be at the same cliff edge with the same prime minister.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but thanks all, and we'll be back after this.
It's time to focus.
I think ultimately that ideology is fading, but it will have a sting in the tail, and we see that sometimes with these flare-ups and violence.
Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anoushka Astana, for the best stories from our journalists around the world. Subscribe now to Today in Focus from The Guardian.
Welcome back. Now, it's hard to imagine, but Brexit could be the least of the Tory party's problems. Tory voters have always skewed older, but a new report says that the average age at which people become more likely to vote Conservative than Labour is now 51, up from 34 before the 2017 election. Could this spell the end of the Tory party in the not-too-distant future? So Will, who's here with us, authored this report. These statistics are staggering, aren't they? You say that only 16% of under 35 said that they would currently vote for the Conservatives, and just 17% of Tory voters are aged under 45, and only 4% under 25. It feels worse than anyone thought it was, right?
It's definitely getting worse, and one of the reasons why we commissioned this report was precisely to understand what had happened since 2017. That was the first election where age was the big dividing line in politics. Previously, it was class and income, which predicted the way in which people would vote. So we wanted to understand what had happened since and what was driving that trend. I think it's fair to say the results have actually be met with kind of the right level of response from the Conservative Party and from the kind of broader centre-right. People have woken up to the scale of the challenge, but there's a hell of a lot of work to do for the Conservatives to actually start to reverse that age gap and get back into the kind of good books of lots of younger generations who they're losing in droves.
And if they don't do that work, how long do you give the Tory party before it becomes extinct?
Well, I think, so the interesting thing is actually not just the extent to which the Conservative Party is becoming much older. It is. But also the fact that the Labour Party has a bit of a hard ceiling amongst older voters. So currently the Labour Party is kind of getting historic numbers of young people to vote for it, but it's losing support amongst over 65s. And there are only about 2 or 3% of over 65s who would consider voting Labour, but don't do so already. So Labour's basically got a hard ceiling. It's very difficult to see how they increase their share of the vote amongst the older generations. So both parties face struggles, actually, in this new kind of age-divided politics. Both need to change the way they operate in order to respond.
And isn't Brexit, if delivered, going to make the Tory party problem with young people even worse?
Actually, one of the more interesting findings in our report, we identified 3 million under 35s who would consider voting Tory but don't currently do so. Brexit isn't a dividing line for those people. About half of them voted Leave, about half of them voted Remain. These people aren't driven by Brexit. They're driven by broader brand and values. And bluntly, they want to see the Conservative Party putting across bold, optimistic policies to make their lives better rather than focusing on things like Brexit that is just dividing the country further.
So one of the things that you suggest the Conservative Party could do to attract younger voters is lower taxes, which I found quite surprising. Is that really something that young people are going to go for?
Absolutely. We've got this kind of slightly mythical view of young people as being very in favour of high public spending, being willing to pay kind of Swedish-style taxes. It's fundamentally not true. 18 to 24-year-olds are the most in favour of keeping more of their own money, of lower taxes.
Why are they all voting Labour then?
I personally put it down to a kind of moral and fairness question. Lots of young people see the economy not in kind of pure financial terms like older generations, the kind of post-Thatcher generation, but actually in moral economy terms. This is the crash generation who have never really known prosperity in any meaningful way, or certainly not prosperity that distributes income to them. They've had 10 years of stagnant wages, and their defining moment in capitalism was the financial crash. They see firms behaving badly in the real economy, and they want those firms tackled. Now, that lends itself to a kind of a narrative that Jeremy Corbyn is picking up upon, that doesn't mean that they want a socialist state. It doesn't mean they want huge public spending, and they're not willing to pay sky-high taxes.
Do you buy that, Owen?
That tax point is, I think, just reflective of the fact that living standards for young people have crashed over the last 10 years. They've gone down by 10% amongst younger Britons. A lot of them also see coming out their pay packets tuition fees, which again are eating into their living standards, and they can't save for deposits and so on. And Labour aren't pledging to increase their taxes anyway. Labour committed to freeze 95% of people's taxes and only increase taxes for the top 5%. So in that sense, that point, I think, is just moot. I mean, in terms of what I think is what should worry the Conservatives, without getting too complacent, in 1983, when Margaret Thatcher won a landslide, she had a 9-point lead amongst 18 to 24-year-olds. And it's also, given it's often seen that young people, naive, left-wing, become, you know, grow up and get a brain and become conservative, younger people in America were more likely to support Reagan than older Americans. And now in America, they're the most pro-Bernie Sanders cohort. When you end up with, what, you know, such an overwhelming lead amongst the working age population, I think Labour have a 20-point lead overall with under 65-year-olds. So that fluctuates depending on the polling. There obviously is a big, big problem there. The way I would see it, I'd be interested to see what you think, is twofold. I think, firstly, even though we do have huge pensioner poverty, 1.9 million pensioners still live in poverty, social security has been preserved for older people. There's the triple lock, which the Conservatives were stupid enough to try and fiddle with. But home ownership has also gone up amongst older people. And they're also far more socially conservative. Immigration, multiculturalism, Islam, LGBTQ rights, feminism. And then you have a working age population which has suffered the worst squeeze in wages of any industrialised country other than Greece, the worst squeeze since the Napoleonic War, where home ownership is in a state of collapse, not least amongst younger Britons, where they're driven into an unregulated private rented sector, often paying huge amounts of their wages, which are stagnating and falling. You know, everything from saddled with debt with tuition fees to the decimation of youth services, to the lack of secure jobs, the rise of the delivery economy, you can see why. And they are more progressive on immigration, on Islam and all the rest, and LGBTQ rights.
What I was interested in about your report, Will, is that you were suggesting controlling immigration as a way of attracting younger voters. That didn't chime with what we think and know about young people.
Indeed, and I would urge Owen to read the report in full, because there's lots in there that actually contradicts much of what he just said. So actually, 18 to 24-year-olds have net support for reducing immigration, not increasing immigration. 18 to 24-year-olds are more in favour of making making public services more efficient than spending more taxpayers' money on them. So you may be right about taxes, and we do in the report point to the fact that disposable income and tuition fees might be part of the reason why young people are more supportive of lower taxes.
Well, there's another important reason. The young have always been quite not in, the very young, under 24s, not in favour of extra taxes, because they use public services so little, particularly now they don't even get their fees paid. It's not until you have children, and then suddenly you need the NHS, you need schools, you need nurseries, you need free childcare, and suddenly you understand what the welfare state's for. But you don't really until you reach that stage in life, or until you're identifying with people or have family in those stages in life. So I'm not surprised by that, and I don't think it means that they've suddenly turned right wing.
Could you see the Tory party ever attracting younger voters back to its folds?
I find it quite hard to imagine, because when you look at this, the leadership roundup, and you look at what they're saying, I mean, even Matt Hancock, who's trying to present himself as some kind of moderniser, is producing extremely negative and dark things. He keeps saying, we must be optimistic. But apart from saying we must be optimistic, he hasn't actually produced a single optimistic or creative idea.
It feels a long way from David Cameron's Huskies, doesn't it, Will?
Well, so I mean, we talk about the Conservative Party not being able to win over young people. Just 9 years ago, the Conservative Party had an 8-point lead amongst 25 to 34-year-olds. That's people my age. Were voting.
9 years is a long time in politics, isn't it?
And that was just after the crash, and it was every government that had been responsible during the crash fell. And that was a very different situation.
Okay, so let me give you another statistic. Those 3 million under 35s who say they would be certain or likely to vote for the Conservative Party in a future election, but would not do so if there was an election today. That's 3 million voters who could, frankly, if the Conservative Party won over those voters, they could swing the election hugely in their favour and win a decisive majority.
I would say if you want to go on about, if Tories want to go on about controlling immigration, I think fill their boots. They have been doing that obsessively. The rhetoric on immigration has been toxic and unrelenting. I don't think they're slacking on the anti-immigrant message, not least under Theresa May. I think the problem with that, you know, when you say, well, actually, majority of more young people than not support reducing immigration, every demographic in Britain supports reducing immigration. That's true.
I agree. Yeah.
But the two problems with that are, A, amongst younger people, it's a lot less than older people. There's far more pro-immigration sentiment. The second is that if you look at polling, pro-immigration sentiment has increased actually quite dramatically over the last few years. It's going in one direction only at the moment. The third problem is there's a difference between saying, on balance, I think we should reduce immigration, and it A, not being a priority, and B, when you hear rhetoric, inflammatory rhetoric, you go, oh, hold on a minute, I might have that opinion, but this is a bit much for me. The Tories, as I've said, the reason they've toxified their brand so much is partly over immigration.
But frankly, Owen, you've just reiterated three reasons why the Conservative Party is right to reflect public opinion on immigration.
I mean, it doesn't seem to be doing it massive favours at the moment, though, does it? It's not way ahead in the polls.
You could argue that where we are in the political cycle, Labour should be much, much further ahead in the polls than they currently are. I mean, immigration is one issue where actually we find that Labour has a marginal lead over the Conservatives for the first time in a long time. So it is clear that public opinion is not trusting of the Conservative Party on immigration, but I don't think that's necessarily because they're not doing enough to open up our borders. It's actually arguably because the Conservative Party has spent 9 years in government and hasn't significantly reduced net migration like they said they would.
Do you think the Tories should speak more about immigration than they currently are now to win over younger people?
We do think that immigration is part of a centre-ground message which can appeal to all generations. Actually, if they want to win specifically over young people, we'd say that things like talking about the environment, talking about reducing the gap between rich and poor, talking about the kind of moral economy and making sure that companies take a social role in the economy as well as just a purely financial profit-making role will be important to win over young people.
My goodness, you've really shown how far the Tory party has moved to the right. If you look back at the time of when Enoch Powell was utterly shunned, when Ted Heath would have none of it, the idea that you're now saying immigration is a good way for the Tories to win is actually, frankly, horrific. We should draw back a bit and say, hang on a minute, we didn't used to be that country. We are not that country. And, you know, everything that leaders do to encourage us to be anti-immigration, it's always there. I mean, that sort of atavistic gut sense is there in any country, and it can be aroused by bad leaders and used by demagogues.
Well, I'm really sorry, everyone, but we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much, though. My thanks to all our guests, Owen Jones, Will Tanner and Polly Toynbee. The producer was Simon Barnard. I'm Sonia Soder. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.